Chapter 76. Big Money. Despite the formal proscription of any type of annexation by Wilson's 14 points, the Allies had done everything to reverse this policy. On the issue of reparations, the American delegate John Foster Dulles had declared that the peace conference would be in the presence of a contract limiting the right of the Allies, the armistice. This is not a blank page, but a page black with text, signed by Wilson, Clemenceau, Orlando, and Lloyd George. The United States' proposal is, in consequence, that reparations should be demanded from Germany, but only those that were stipulated during the contract undertaken with Germany concerning the conditions for peace. Tardieu, Peace, page 317. Dulles's demand that the contract be adhered to met with immediate opposition. The Serbian delegate Prodic, who had so swiftly thrust his claws on 9 million non-Serbians, insisted that only Germany was obligated to abide by the contract. The 14 points, he declared, were only valid for Germany and not for the Allies. Tardieu, page 18. Thus, Germany would be bound by the agreement, but not the Allies. The fact that such blatant inequity could be promoted seriously at the peace conference was indicative of the Allies' frame of mind. The Jewish finance minister Klotz, representing France, insisted for his part that the German-Allied agreement was only valid for the day it had been signed. Dulles reminded the conference. The diplomatic correspondence of October 1918 had for its objective not a basis for the armistice but a basis for peace. The conference had been entrusted to deal with peace, and nothing could change what had been accepted as the basis for peace. Tardieu, page 319. The British, who had already helped themselves to German assets, colonies and ships, demanded that reparations be paid by Germany for all the damages caused to civilian populations. Here again the interpretation of the amount of reparations was left to the Allies. Clemenceau was unequivocal. It is important to state that our right to compensation is not limited. The Allies proceeded to draw up a huge reparations bill. In an unusual burst of candor, the British economist John Maynard Keynes calculated that the French reparations bill of $250 billion was almost as large as France's gross national product. He asked rhetorically, "If you had to spend the money you want for the reconstruction of France's devastated northern regions, I can state you would not be able to use it." Tardieu, page 386. Belgian politicians were demanding reparations larger than the total pre-war wealth of the country, despite the fact that Brussels, Antwerp, and Ostend had been spared the ravages of war. Keynes calculated, the real price of replacing industrial plants and equipment was not very high, and a few scores of millions would well cover the total value of all the machines Belgium could ever have owned. Keynes, The Economic Consequences of the Peace, page 104. The politicians had even gone so far as to demand the benefits and profits Belgians might have realized without the war. During the war, the Belgian merchant classes had accumulated more than 6 billion German marks while trading with the allegedly barbaric Huns. Corrupt governments and banks went on a frenzy of currency trafficking, made legal for parties of means and influence. At taxpayers' expense, the Belgian government bought post-war German currency at pre-armistice prices, despite the sharp decline in the mark's value by the year 1919. As usual, the people paid the price for this banking scam. Another vociferous claimant was the Prime Minister of Australia, Bill Hughes. Australian politicians were vying with one another to do their British master's bidding. Theoretically an independent nation, Australia had declared war on Germany, although it had no dispute with Germany. During the war, it seized the German Pacific territories, persecuted its own large German population, which had contributed so much to the country's development, as well as its Irish population, who were in favor of remaining neutral. As in previous British wars, Australian troops had been transported some 9,000 miles away from their homeland to fight for the mother country. It is astounding that Hughes should have the audacity to ask Germany for reparations. If the Australian government had been so eager to fight Britain's wars, it should have been Britain which paid the bill. Yet here was the wily Welshman of Australia demanding, if an Australian sheep farmer had to mortgage his house because of the crisis caused by the war, and if he ended up losing his house, this loss would constitute a war expense to be reimbursed by Germany. What happened in Paris, page 210. One thing these outrageous claims had in common was material greed of the vilest kind. All clamored for billions against the loss of property, but nothing was said about the loss of human life on the battlefields. The governments and the super-rich bankers would fill their pockets, but not a dime would go for the millions who had lost their kin except for miserable pensions. The bureaucrats, however, fared a lot better. Hefty claims were made on their behalf. War pensions were awarded to legions of officeholders who had never seen a battlefield, and who had spent the war in the comfort and faceless anonymity of government sinecures. While the Allies were counting their reparation billions, they had failed to find out whether Germany was in any position to pay. Germany had been bled white during 4 years of war on two fronts. The armistice had just deprived her of 5,000 locomotives, 150,000 railway cars and 5,000 trucks, which, in those days, was a considerable number. Within months Germany had lost the coal, iron ore and other minerals of Alsace-Lorraine and Saarland, the agricultural produce of West Prussia as well as the mines of Silesia, all of which had been requisitioned by the Allies. More than 2 million soldiers had died at the front, while 3 million others were too disabled to work in industry. During the winter of 1918 to 19, hundreds of thousands of children died of cold or starvation because the Allies kept Germany blockaded, despite the armistice, for 6 long months. The communists sent by Lenin had further undermined the country's economy through strikes and organized sabotage. Germany was exhausted, her means to recover had been taken away by the Allies. Blinded by hatred and stupidity, the Allies wanted to extract billions from Germany and at the same time destroy the country's viability. Politicians were prisoners of the blind hatred they had promoted for years. The real crime of war, even more than killing, is to poison the masses with hatred, making it impossible for generations to return to reason and objectivity, thus laying the groundwork for the next war. Just as they had fanned hatred to get their people to fight for the economic interests of the few, the politicians were now fanning hatred for electoral advantages. In 1919, Clemenceau had had the power to lead public opinion to a constructive policy of realism and reconciliation, but he opted for vengeance. Lloyd George, likewise, whether he believed in destroying Germany or not, was caught up in the hatred he had generated for 4 years, and joined the chorus for reparations. Wilson may have disapproved, but he seemed powerless to do anything about it. On the Allied side, a few men made known their misgivings about imposing such a burden on Germany. The English delegate, Harold Nicholson, showed remarkable objectivity throughout the proceedings. Even Churchill and House, at the end, could see that the treaty would be counterproductive. Strangely, it was the economist John Maynard Keynes, then a university professor, who appealed for a modicum of reflection and moderation among the delegates. He produced facts and figures which showed conclusively that if Germany were crushed, it would not be in a position to pay any reparations. It would appear that such an elementary proposition could be understood by anyone, but it was lost on the Allies. Keynes pointed out, "The only consideration now is to establish whether Germany is in position to pay what to whom." He estimated that Belgium had incurred losses of £500 million sterling, France's losses amounted to £900 million and Britain's £540 million. Another £250 million were calculated for the Allies' client states. The total came up to a little more than £2 billion sterling, or $10 billion. This figure was, incidentally, 10 times more than what Germany had demanded from France after its 1871 victory. Keynes concluded, "We are conscious that these figures are correct. We can say that according to the commitments undertaken by the Allied powers before the armistice, Germany's liability is somewhere between £1.6 and £3 billion sterling. This is the amount we are entitled to demand from the enemy." Keynes, Economic Consequences of the Peace, page 114. Later, Keynes added, It would have been wise just to ask the German government during the peace negotiations to agree to pay £2 billion as a final settlement without sticking further to details. This would have provided a firm and immediate solution. We would have asked Germany to pay an amount within its reach in exchange for certain concessions. This sum would have then been shared by the Allies according to their needs and according to equity. The American delegation demanded that Germany should pay $5 billion before May 1, 1921, 2 years after the Versailles Treaty. The American report stated, "After this day, it would not appear unreasonable to recover another $25 billion. It was necessary, in order to obtain this result, that the other clauses of the treaty did not drain Germany's economic resources. Furthermore, the treaty should not obstruct by way of tariffs or otherwise the redevelopment of German industry. Finally, Germany should be allowed to settle a reasonable part of its debt in German marks." What happened in Paris, page 215. Despite this proposal, drastic clauses, which gave the victors advantageous tariffs and precluded Germany from paying any reparations in marks, were imposed. Lloyd George had promised the British voters to squeeze the German lemon until the pip squeaked, a slogan coined by Sir Eric Geddes, and Clemenceau kept the crowds in a frenzy of vengeful expectation. People were encouraged to present astronomical claims. Every woman had suddenly lost her weight in gold and diamonds, every man had lost mansions and business empires. In the official claims list one could read, reparation for mistreatment, 1.87 billion gold francs, loss of salary, 223 million gold francs, hardship to civilians, 1.27 billion gold francs. Altogether, the reparations bill reached into the trillions. Tardieu himself described these fantastic figures. "We reached a total of $1,000 billion, to be paid within 50 years. With interest it would be $3,000 billion, an enormous sum, almost unreal. Yet if we were to abide to the end, the principle of reparation in full, we would also claim, in accordance with justice, indirect damages, business losses, earning losses, etc. We would get to a fabulous total of 7,000, 8,000, 10,000 billion. Tardieu, Peace, page 320. With such figures exceeding the amount calculated by experts more than 2,000 times, and championed excitedly by millions of people, there was little chance that reason would prevail. Tardieu took note that members of the British cabinet had been unanimous in thinking that Germany was asked to pay more than it could. They demanded that the unlimited and indefinite character of the debt imposed on Germany consequently be fundamentally revised. Lloyd George may have agreed, but he replied, "I take the pulse of public opinion and I must take it into account." Public opinion, created by the press and politicians, was taking precedence over sanity. Tardieu and Clemenceau did not budge from their position that France would refuse to give up its right to be fully compensated. Thus the Allies would embark on a policy of squeezing trillions from Germany, a recipe for social upheaval and eventual war.